Hello, world. Welcome to Discover Your Talent, Do What You Love, number 212. I'm creator and host, Don Hutchison. Every day, I interview someone from around the world who has discovered his talents to do work he loves, to create a life of success, satisfaction, and freedom. Today, I'm delighted to bring you our featured guest, Jim Akhmoudi. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Don. I'm happy to be here.
It's my pleasure. Jim, are you using your talents doing work that you love?
Yes, I am.
Good. We want to hear the whole story. Jim Akhmoudi is a writer in Atlanta, where he worked as a reporter and editor with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution for 29 years. He's the author of the book, The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and The Long Road to Forgiveness, a tale of race, religion, and reconciliation set in Koinonia, the community farm in Georgia that gave birth to Habitat for Humanity. His next book will be A History of Barbecue, Koinonia. Jim, that's a pithy summary of your career. Tell us what you're up to now.
Well, The Class of 65, the book I published earlier this year, is still very much on my mind. It's the first nonfiction narrative book like this I've done, and it's a story that's really close to my heart. This community, Koinonia, it was a really unusual experimental Christian communal farm in southwest Georgia. And the residents there believed in racial equality and pacifism at a time when those were really dangerous concepts in the Deep South. During the 50s, when the Civil Rights Revolution came to rural Georgia, Koinonia was persecuted, shot at, boycotted for years. The farm's children had a particularly hard time when they entered the local high school and found themselves blamed for the social changes most of their classmates angrily opposed. And my story focuses on one of the teenagers who went through all that. Greg Whitcamper is his name. He was the only child from this farm the year that his high school, America's High School, was forced to desegregate. And he went through hell. He was assaulted, harassed, called names, spit on. And through it all, he never fought back against these people. But the twist on the story, and what really attracted me to it, was the fact that it isn't just about ugly things that happened in the Deep South half a century ago. It's about reconciliation. Because some of Greg's classmates, many years later, when they were coming up on their 40th reunion, they tracked him down in West Virginia, where he'd been living for years, and wrote these beautiful letters of apology, inviting them to come back to their reunion. And so the story is almost equally about how these people, who had been stereotypical children of segregation back in the 60s, how they changed, how they broadened, and how they reached out to this person. So it's about forgiveness and our capacity for change as much as it's about intolerance and religious persecution.
Mm-hmm. I look forward to reading that very much, being in the class of 65 myself. What was the catalyst to get you to write this? Why did you write this story?
I had known about Koinonia for a long time. My first job out of college was with the Southern Presbyterian Church's magazine. And we had a writer there who told me about Koinonia and wanted to write a story, a feature story for us about it. And I heard all about their history. And so when I started at the Journal-Constitution as an editor, really, in 1980, literally the first out-of-town assignment I took was to drive down to America's and write a feature story about Koinonia.
Ah.
And it was in the fall of 1980. And I remember that you could still see bullet holes in some of the farm buildings where they had been shot at back in the 50s.
Oof.
And that made a real impression on me. And I went to America's a lot of times over the years. There's a lot of history there. I wrote about Andersonville, the Civil War prisoner of war camp that's on the northern edge of the county there. I wrote a lot about the Carters because their plains is only about 7 or 8 miles from Koinonia. I wrote about Habitat for Humanity and when it was becoming a big deal in the 80s and 90s. But I always sort of stayed in touch with the Koinonia story. And then in the summer of 2006, my wife and I were on vacation out in Rocky Mountain National Park. I actually checked my voicemail back at work, and I had this voicemail from a former editor of mine who was telling me about this reunion in Georgia that she thought would just be a perfect story for me. She, as it turned out, she had actually grown up in Roanoke, Virginia, with a woman who married the person who became my main character in this book, Greg Whitcamper. And she had just been at a gathering with him. And this was about a month after their 40th reunion. That's sort of the centerpiece of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And she was telling me all about the things he went through in high school and the background of Koinonia and how they were so excited about this reunion and what a warm and really healing thing it had been for them. And she just thought it was a perfect story for me. So when I got back in the office, I tracked the guy down in West Virginia and started working on it.
Wow. Wonderful. 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 Good luck with that book. I'm sure it's going to have a good following.
Thank you.
As you well know, everyone's life journey is composed of a series of turning points. Some call them passages. And at these times, we're faced with obstacles and opportunities and choices that determine the course of the next handful of years of our lives. Take us back as far as you will, Jim, in your backstory, and tell us about the more memorable turning points that have made Jim Ockmoody, Jim Ockmoody.
Well, my impulse to be a journalist and tell stories for a living really comes from my father. My father, Charles Robert Ockmoody Jr., was a child of the Depression. He grew up on a farm in Bartow County in northwest Georgia, and they didn't have a lot of money, and he was really the first member of the family who went to college. But he went to Berry College in Rome, Georgia, where people who came from mountain families and that didn't have any money could go and work their way through school. Berry's changed since then. It's now a very fine, well-regarded liberal arts institution. But back then, it was really more for poor mountain children to work their way through school. And my father was that. And they didn't have a journalism program at Berry. And, you know, after he went off and fought in World War II, he was in the Navy in the Pacific during World War II, comes back home to Georgia, gets married, starts a family. And he got the first good-paying job he could find to support a family. He became an accountant, an auditor at General Motors. And
back then, that was a great job, wasn't it?
That was a great job. He was working for General Motors in the 1940s and 50s and 60s in Atlanta. And working for General Motors was, you know, like working for Apple now. It was the most prestigious company in America during those years. But it was a long way away from his love, which was storytelling. And many years later, when I was getting into newspapers, he was so, so proud of me. And he used to tell me that, you know, you're doing what I wish I had been able to do. I grew up in Atlanta pretty much during the 60s. And I came at my interest in storytelling and in journalism really more from an interest in history. My formative years, when I was really starting to pay attention to the world, were the 60s in Atlanta. And what was going on then was two bookend things that really speak to the heart of the American experience. The civil rights movement was unfolding right before our eyes in the South during those years. And I didn't really understand it. It was interesting to me. And it was kind of upsetting and interesting to a young white boy growing up in the Deep South like that.
Yes.
But at the same time, we were going through the Civil War centennial years from 1961 to 1965. And I loved history. I was acutely aware of the fact that my hometown had been conquered and burned down during a war, which is a very rare thing for anybody's hometown to have that kind of history in America.
Yes.
There are really only a handful of cities that have that kind of experience. Columbia, South Carolina would be another one. But I would conflate the two things. I would think that the civil rights movement had something to do with the fact that this invading army had destroyed my hometown. And obviously, in one way, I was completely ridiculously misinformed to think that the two things were related. But then you find out a lot more about American history and you find out that, well, yes, of course they're related. They're two chapters in the same ongoing saga. So when I was growing up in the 60s in Atlanta, I was keenly aware that history was not something that happened to other people in other places. It happened to my people in my hometown, and it made me very interested in those stories.
Yes. Well, what happened next in the storyline? What was the next big turning point?
Well, I went to school, and I always thought I was going to go to University of Georgia to study journalism or maybe the University of North Carolina to study history. But I ended up staying in Atlanta and going to Georgia State University. And the main reason I stayed in Atlanta was because I was starting to do some freelance writing. I was writing for the Sunday Magazine of the Journal Constitution. I was writing for a couple of alternative weeklies here. I was starting to do what I thought I was going to do for a living.
And you were just out of high school?
This was a couple of years on. This was like in my last 2 years of college, senior year.
Okay, good. Yeah.
And I was working on the student newspaper at Georgia State, too, the Signal. Okay. So I was starting to figure out how I could actually make a living out of my interest in history and storytelling. And what I figured out was, of course, that I could do that through journalism. And I should mention one other thing in my family that was going on at that time. I have an older brother, Chuck, 5 years older than me, who was a really gifted baseball player. We were really loved baseball when I was growing up, and he was a terrific pitcher who actually got signed by the Chicago White Sox.
Wow.
And played 3 years in their minor league system. And this was all when I was in high school. And the vast majority of people who get signed to minor league contracts never make it to the majors.
Mm-hmm.
And Chuck had a really good fastball and a really good curveball, but he just wasn't quite able to put it all together to make a major league career. And after his professional baseball career flamed out after 3 seasons, he was disappointed, but it didn't end his life. You know, he didn't start drinking or become a screw up or anything like that. He just got on with his life. He pursued other things. And, you know, I guess what I took from that was that you deal with whatever life brings to you. You have to make the best of it. Sometimes all your grandest dreams might not come true, but it doesn't mean that your life is over and that you can't be a solid and productive person.
Well said. Well said.
And my brother's certainly that. And so I kind of feel like in some ways I was able to do the things that I wanted to do. Chuck really wasn't able to do his first dream, but he has done very well with a plan B. He also worked at General Motors. He became a line worker at the assembly plant in Doraville. And there is nothing wrong with that. He has had a good life, and he's just the best older brother you could ask for, and he's always been very happy for me. I think you can tell we have a really loving and supporting family, and
yes,
that's always been very important to me.
Yes, that's a great story. So when did you make the step into the AJC?
Well, I worked for a couple of years for the Presbyterian Church's magazine here in Atlanta. But the whole time I had been writing freelance stories for the AJC, and they were interested in hiring me. And after I'd been at the Presbyterian magazine for only 2 years, they hired me as the assistant features editor of the Constitution. Hmm. The staffs were separate then. And so I was pretty young for getting hired for a job like that. I was 24 years old. I had never worked for another daily newspaper. That was, as a matter of fact, the AJC is the only daily newspaper I've ever worked for.
A word.
And I was hired as an assistant features editor. I was editing and helping reporters who were much older than I was, editing their copy and making assignments. And I was learning a lot from them. I had a lot of examples of really fine writers right there next to me who were just showing me how it was done. And I was able to sort of go to school on them as I was actually being the first editor on their copy. And it was just the best job in the world. I was at the Journal Constitution for almost 30 years, from 1980 until 2009. And with the exception of maybe 6 months of unhappiness in there, it was just all wonderful. I was able to do the kinds of stories I wanted to do. I liked them. They liked me. I had a very positive work experience there.
Yes, yes. What was the most gratifying part of being in that role at a major newspaper? What aspects of the job, of the task, were the most gratifying to you?
Well, I didn't stay an editor for very long. When they hired me, the whole idea was that I was going to become a writer. And I was an editor there maybe for about 2 years, and then I went off and became a general assignment feature writer. And I never covered a beat. I never went down to the police station all the time to see what kind of crimes had happened. Never was full-time at the state capitol. I was always general assignment, which meant I did anything and everything. And the most satisfying thing was just getting your teeth into a really good story, whether it was, you know, had to do with the history of the South and the culture of the South, whether it had to do with things that were off of politics and crime. I did a lot of food writing. I always enjoyed that. You know, I did sports. I covered a World Series in actually 1995, the year the Braves won the World Series. I got to cover that World Series, which was really great.
Wow. You just reported to a senior editor and you would plot out a story, a path of stories over a month, 2 months, a week. How would that work? How would the planning process work?
I worked usually on weekly features. I was a person who wrote takeout stories for the Sunday paper,
okay,
and with occasional breaks for projects, things that might take anywhere from a month to 6 months, multi-part projects. And so I was kind of the long-form guy. I was the guy who would tell a tale. And I worked in features and the city desk, but most of my time was spent in features. But I remember there was this one city desk reporter, editor I had who I really liked, at very early in my time there, he gave me some assignment. This always stuck with me. He was telling me what he thought the story was and, you know, some leads on how to report it and everything. And then as he was like pushing me out his office door, he said, "Moody, go spin me a yarn," which just sounds like real old fashioned newspaper stuff. But that's exactly, I was the guy who would go out and spin the yarn.
Wow. Wow. Fabulous. Name the story that sticks in your mind as one that was the most satisfying to work on. I know there were hundreds and hundreds, but does any one or two stories stand out?
Well, I mean, probably the most satisfying story I ever did is the one that became this book, The Class of 65. That actually started as a feature story in the Journal Constitution in 2006.
Okay.
I went and reported that reunion, and I went and talked to the people down in Americus, went up to West Virginia, talked to my main character, Greg, and some of the people there, and wrote, you know, a fairly lengthy story that ran on the front page of the Sunday paper. And just got an enormous response from people. It really hit an emotional chord, I think. It probably got more response than any story I'd ever written that didn't have to do with cats or coconut cake. But there were other stories. I mean, you know, one of the ones I remember really vividly was a piece I did in 1991 about this fellow, Forrest Carter, who had written a bestseller book called The Education of Little Tree. And it's just a charming book about this young man in Alabama who's pretty much raised by this Cherokee Indian. And the story had to do with the fact that this guy, Forrest Carter, who was writing all this heartwarming stuff that had found a real audience late in his life, he had just died. And it turned out that he had this backstory that was really ugly. He had been a speechwriter for George Wallace and had been kind of a racist thug back in the 50s. He had, when they tried to desegregate the University of Alabama, he was part of the group that roughed up some of the folks there. He was this violent character, and it was a great mystery, and it had to do with the good and the bad things about the South, which is what I'm all about. And it also tested your ability to hold conflicting thoughts in your mind. How could a person who wrote these beautiful, heartwarming things about childhood in the 1970s be the same person who wrote these really ugly, bigoted things back in the 50s?
Mm-hmm.
And of course he could be the same person.
Right.
Everybody has dark and light in them. His was just more vivid than others.
Exactly. Let me take you to another place in the theme here about the fact that most people don't get to do what they really think they want to do. Your brother in baseball is an example, and he's an example of somebody who turned it around and built a really very meaningful life. Why is it that, do you think, that somebody like you was able to have a passion early on and follow through with it and have the right opportunities in front of them, take advantage of them, but the fact that 86% of the people around the world and 70-some-odd percent of the people in this country aren't able to do that? What are the obstacles that are game stoppers?
Well, when I look back at my career, I think what was really key was flexibility. I learned pretty early on that what I was in love with was storytelling. What I was in love with wasn't being a daily newspaper print reporter. It was storytelling.
Right.
And if you find out what it is that's really at the heart of what you love, instead of the position or the salary or the job, that's very important because it sort of gives you a built-in flexibility to go with your passion instead of going with the office.
Well, that's a very insightful comment. Very insightful.
And it really came to play for me because obviously late in my time at the Journal Constitution, after 2000, the newspaper business completely changed. And the advertising base, the classified advertisements, went to the internet. A lot of the advertising went to the internet. Circulations went down. The whole business model for daily print newspapers changed.
Right.
And I think the fact that I had always been a general assignment reporter actually helped me a lot with my flexibility because my job year in and year out, week in and week out, was to take whatever story came my way and to make the best of it and find what was interesting in it. So I find myself being able to get interested in just about anything because I developed that habit over 30 years as a newspaper reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the stories I did were things I originated. They were my ideas, but a good many of them came from other people. And you have to realize that sometimes when other people come to you with an idea, even if it initially doesn't sound like something you'd be interested in, you really owe it to yourself to give it a chance and try to get interested in it. I know I had one editor who told me the good thing about Acme is he can get interested in anything.
Okay.
And I think being able to get interested in anything is awfully important in life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's awfully important in retirement. If you get retired and if you retire and you find yourself not being engaged and interested in things,
that's bad.
That's called boredom.
That's called boredom, and it's not good for your health. So what aspects of your life, Jim, have been most profoundly touched or impacted by you being able to be flexible in your career and see opportunities, move forward, take advantage of them, and keep moving your career forward for 30 years? What have been the most palpable benefits?
Well, the biggest thing for me was being able to say goodbye to my comfort zone. I had been at the newspaper for 30 years when everything was starting to change and they were starting to downsize staffs. And I certainly could have stayed at the newspaper. I ended up taking a buyout offer to leave, and they would have been happy if I had stayed there. I could be there right now, and I dare say I'd be making a lot more money than I'm making right now, but I don't think I would be happier. I decided that I wanted to do other types of storytelling. I wanted to do books, and I wanted to do writing for online publications, and I thought it was, after 30 years, it was a good time to leave the newspaper and try my hand at these other things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was a scary decision, really, because I was so used to doing things a certain way and having a certain status that came from being a pretty well-known reporter at a major newspaper. And all of a sudden, you're not doing that. And the first year or so I was away from that, it was a pretty difficult adjustment. I've seen an awful lot of friends of mine, colleagues at the Journal-Constitution, who left during that downsizing period, have to reinvent themselves. Some of them haven't done it. Some of them have basically just retired, and they're enjoying themselves now. They're playing golf, or they're selling antiques, or doing whatever else they're interested in. And, you know, but there are a number of my friends who've sort of taken the skills that they had as newspaper people, and they have turned them into new jobs. They follow their passion in a different way. I'm an example of that. I have a very good friend who was the food editor at the newspaper for about 20 years, and she's doing great. She is co-writing cookbooks with chefs. She's helping chefs tell their stories, and she's done some really fine work with that. She's really followed her interest in food and become an entrepreneur. I mean, that's the most obvious thing here, is that you go from being an employee for a large institution like I was to being responsible for your career well-being. You have to become an entrepreneur. And there's always a little bit of that, even when I was a daily newspaper reporter, because you're an entrepreneur in the sense that you're having sort of figure out what you're working on next. But now you're an entrepreneur in the bigger sense that you have to figure out what's going to bring in money.
Yeah, exactly. So what do you see happening? What's your vision going forward in the next handful of years? I mean, you've still got plenty of productive time left. How do you see playing this out? Doing more of the same with more books and other assignments like that?
Yeah, actually, that is what I'm going to do. I'm going to keep doing books. They may not be traditional books, though. They may not be, you know, this first book I did, The Class of 65, was a very traditional experience. I wrote a book proposal, a nonfiction book proposal, using a New York agent, and did it through a New York publisher. It is not much different from how you would have sold a book 30 years ago, except for the fact that we were doing it all with emails and PDFs.
Yes.
You know, going forward, I may get into self-publishing more or publishing on demand. I did this first one this way because I wanted to learn how to make a book. But now, once you sort of learn that, you aren't necessarily beholden to doing it the same way.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. There's so many people self-publishing. There's so many great firms that are out there helping authors do that in non-traditional ways now. There are many, many, and they're doing a great job. So what are you proudest of?
What am I proudest of? I'm proud of any time I write a story that people tell me that it helped change their life, or it really moved them, or it pointed out something about the world that they hadn't really thought about. And I'm particularly proud of this one, The Class of 65, because I think it meets all those criteria.
Jim Ockmoody, what a great pleasure being with you today. We appreciate you sharing the highlights of your very fascinating life journey, and I know that our listeners have learned lessons that will help them in their journey. How do listeners get in touch with you if you would like them to?
Well, I have a website, jimockmoody.com. Should I spell the name?
Yes, please.
J-I-M-A-U-C-H-M-U-T-E-Y. com. It's got all the information about the latest book. It's got information about the upcoming book, about the history of barbecue, which we really didn't talk about, but that's going to be very fun and very labor of love. You know, when I was at the Journal-Constitution, I always went back and forth between doing sort of serious things like this book, The Class of 65, and things that had to do with food, which is really an exercise in cultural anthropology, I would say. And I'm going to keep doing that going forward. I mean, I like straddling those worlds.
Good. Excellent. Listeners know you can go to discovertalentpodcast.com, go to the podcast section, find Jim Ockmoody's very fine interview with these links, and it's a direct line to connect with him. I want to thank you, listeners, as I do every day across the world, for joining us. You know that we have an ebook, What Do Highly Successful People Actually Do to Succeed? 12 Proven Career Building Strategies to Help You Do What You Love. Jim's emphasis on flexibility today was an example of one of those strategies and very illuminating. We've had great feedback to this book, and I hope you'll enjoy it. It's free, and people have said it helped them in their career journey. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you like our content, you like our stories, please do. We'd love to have you be a part of our tribe. In closing, every one of us is born with unique talents and gifts. We don't learn them. We can't ignore them. They're just a part of who we are, our DNA. Whenever we discover them and use them in our lives and careers, we do not merely survive, we thrive in every way possible. So until next time, all my best, and whatever you do, have fun out there today.